You can start it off.
Yeah, let me.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, I'm out of the practice here. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Are you recording? All right. From Tuscaloosa, Alabama, this is Aspect Radio. I'm Corey Kraft.
And I'm Ben Flanagan, and we're back.
It's been something of a hiatus.
Yeah, quite a hiatus, an unexpected one. We apologize for the delay, but we're certainly glad to be back, and we've got a lot to cover, a lot of ground to cover. We've seen a lot of movies. You, unsurprisingly, me, surprisingly, I took a look at the list of movies I'd seen from the fall leading into the winter now, and I was surprised at the job I'd done. Usually it takes me a while to get to some of the movies in the theater anyway, but I'm pretty proud of myself. You, on the other hand, you're going to go no matter what.
Well, I feel like I've outdone myself this year.
What's the count this year so far?
213.
Good Lord.
213. But I have been to two film festivals. I feel like that might have contributed to artificially inflate my count.
Is that a number that you would consider yourself proud of, or do you look at that and are you taken aback and think, man, I need to get out of the theater?
I'll plead the fifth on that. I'm not sure where
should I ask your wife that question?
A lot of those have been on DVD release.
Okay.
Just because of the duties of my DVD release column that I write for the Tuscaloosa News. Of course, most of those, if I didn't see it in the theater anyway, there's probably a reason for that, so most of those aren't things that I was particularly interested in seeing, but have had to in the course of the job. So do I regret that? Maybe I regret some of the movies, but it's still, you know, it is what it is.
Well, there's a lot of ground to cover, like I said, especially in terms of news that was released this week. There are a lot of nominations, a lot of awards that have been given out so far, including Golden Globes and SAG, among others. And we'll get to those a little bit later. We'll do a little awards talk and roundup. But first, we do need to catch up on these movies, these many good movies and some bad that we've seen, these major releases that have made their way to Tuscaloosa somehow in a few cases. But I think we should start with what I would call the big daddy right now, one that is a major contender for Best Picture and other major categories. Of course, it's Steven Spielberg's film Lincoln.
This settles the fate for all coming time. Not only of the millions now in bondage, but of unborn millions to come. Shall we stop this bleeding?
And obviously it stars Daniel Day-Lewis as the 16th president and his challenge to get the 13th Amendment passed and thus in the Civil War and the divide that the amendment obviously causes between House Democrats and Republicans leading up to the vote and the challenge again that Lincoln faces convincing House Democrats to vote yes on the 13th Amendment. So we know everything that happens in this movie before we watch it if we're familiar with the Wikipedia entry of Abraham Lincoln's presidency, or at least one section of it. So there's not a lot of suspense in terms of the big picture. But for my money, Spielberg successfully creates suspense in this movie in what is a very talky, often theatrical anyway, depiction of how this all went down in back rooms and in the actual House chambers, in these secret and sometimes public conversations had between politicians. I personally thought that this was done extremely effectively. The performances are all there, especially Daniel Day-Lewis, who is probably the favorite to win the Oscar at this point. And Tommy Lee Jones, James Spader, Michael Stuhlbarg, and another great supporting performance. I mean, we can go down the list. We should throw in Sally Field, too, who I think does a good job. But in your opinion, coming off of the year he had last year with War Horse, which you liked but weren't as high on as me, and you had some problems with perhaps, I guess, I don't know, overly sappy or dramatic direction the film took or the direction that Steven Spielberg applied to it, would you say that this is as sappy in its depiction of Lincoln in American history, or do you think that it's painted with a bit of a finer brush?
Well, I think it would be a tough argument to make that this is a sappy or sentimental movie. I think that was a lot of people had that fear when this project was announced, Spielberg sort of tackling one of the most famous men in American history, indebatably the greatest president in American history, the person who was responsible for achieving so many monumental tasks and sort of guiding the country out of the Civil War. This is large subject matter, and Spielberg, his critics say he has a tendency to sort of paint things broadly. I would say that this is one of his most finely tuned and finessed films in a long time. Of course, he's aided by Tony Kushner's remarkable screenplay and sort of this amazing cast of actors. You've already touched on that a little bit, but that cannot be overstated. It seems like Spielberg in this movie, he's using all of his instinctive gifts as a filmmaker, but this time his instincts said, give these actors this screenplay, turn your camera on, and just let what happens happen. I mean, that's not to say that he doesn't have some pretty fine directorial flourishes here and there, and this is very clearly a Spielberg movie with his frequent band of collaborators like Janusz Kaminski shooting the film, but for my money, like, this is his most nuanced work in forever, and just a really amazing movie. It'd be very difficult for Spielberg haters or critics to look at this and say that it embodies his worst tendencies, because it just doesn't.
There's not much that's overt about this movie in terms of the themes that it's trying to push, the message that it's trying to push. It's not trying to force feed anything, because again, people know what happens here, and there's not a lot that you can really say, again, about the big picture of whether or not the 13th Amendment got passed in the aftermath of it. And what I like so much about it is the subtlety of this, and I think that it's all headed by this rather quiet performance from Daniel Day-Lewis. It's extremely nuanced. You don't get this big, thunderous biopic of Abraham Lincoln that people were expecting initially when Steven Spielberg set out to make this film, and it's been, I think, more than a decade since he started to do that. And what I love about it is that it's about a moment in time. It's about a moment in his presidency. Instead of telling that sprawling story, he took one of the more interesting parts of his presidency and American history and told it in an extremely interesting way. And it is stylish to me, even though it is understated to an extent. Right. I listened to an interview with Janusz Kaminski that he had with Elvis Mitchell on his KCRW show, The Treatment, recently. And it was really interesting because he talked about how this was actually one of the easier shoots of his career because of how static the camera is through most of the movie. And I think he's being pretty modest, to be honest with you, because I think there are some amazing compositions, lighting, as this movie mostly takes place indoors in his presidential office. And again, the house chambers itself.
Well, it's got this sort of dingy candlelit milieu, mostly interiors, you're right.
Light coming through the windows. Right. It's just really beautiful to me. And John Williams does work here as well. Again, another understated job, I think, but it's one of his prettier scores in a while, and I think it serves the film extremely well. I think some of the best scenes of the year are when the house is meeting and they're all shouting at each other and talking about this amendment, what it could mean for the country, equality of mankind. It's just, there are big performances within those scenes, but I think it really paints a great picture of what it was like back then, how those meetings worked and how these folks interacted with each other. Got personal in some cases, but in some regards, it really parallels how it works today. If you ever turn to C-SPAN and see how the House or the Senate operates, it's not unlike how it works today, and especially these backroom dealings, these people trying to buy or intimidate certain votes. I think that's the same thing that happens now. The tactics aren't much different. How he enlists the help of this gang of three involving James Spader and John Hawkes and Tim Blake Nelson. Great characters, and I think the ways they go about their job are pretty funny.
Well, Tommy Lee Jones's character, Thaddeus Stevens, who's this great reformist, abolitionist politician, has a line near the end of the film that I think sums it up. I think it says something like, the 13th Amendment was a moral necessity passed by corruption, aided and abetted by the purest man in America, which sums up the movie pretty well. It is a political procedural, is how I like to call it. But it's never not fascinating to me, but mostly because I think I'm predisposed to like this sort of thing. But, I mean, it's just, you know, rocked by this ensemble and these great scenes and these great moments that Tony Kushner has provided them.
Yeah, someone put it recently like it was the Lincoln story or the story of how the 13th Amendment got passed, given the treatment of someone like Aaron Sorkin. It's kind of Sorkin-esque. And I think that's true to some extent. It does kind of feel like you're watching a film kind of like The Social Network that takes place in the 19th century.
Yeah, the 1860s version of The West Wing.
Yeah, exactly. And it works really well. You have this, again, this moment in time that's driven by the conversations of these people who were involved, what they were like, how they used their politics and were able to conjure up these votes. It's just extremely interesting. It is one of the better films, I think, of latter Spielberg, the latter part of his career anyway, and we're lucky to have it. It's really good. But let's move along to another movie.
Sure.
Oh, hazard, I can do more damage on my laptop sitting in my pajamas before my first cup of Earl Grey than you can do in a year in the field.
Oh, so why do you need me?
Every now and then a trigger has to be pulled.
Or not pulled. It's hard to know which in your pajamas. Q.
007.
How about we next touch on the latest James Bond film, Skyfall?
It's still chugging along at the box office. We might as well.
It's interesting because this movie is starting to sort of rear its head in these awards conversations. And one of the questions you asked, I think, during our holiday preview was, do you think Skyfall is going to figure into the major categories? I said not a chance. I didn't think so because it never had happened with a Bond movie, even under the direction of someone like who had award pedigree or his films had with Mark Forster. That turned out to be a disaster.
Yeah,
this was before we saw Skyfall. And now that we have, it sort of makes sense now that Javier Bardem and Judi Dench are getting this kind of acclaim and the film itself is getting that sort of acclaim and is making as much money as it is. I think it might be the most successful Bond movie to date.
Not adjusted for inflation, but I think...
Just based on pure numbers.
Based on pure numbers, it might be now.
Well, do you think... Now that we've seen it and now that it is getting this consideration, does it deserve it?
Yep. It totally does. Skyfall's awesome. You know, it's something like last year's Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which is a shot of life into this moribund franchise with just really clever action sequences and smart writing that set it, you know, above films of its type. You know, like I think most people, a lot of film fans are excited when Daniel Craig was hired to play James Bond, and Casino Royale was a lot of fun. Quantum of Solace set that back quite a bit, though, because it was just kind of, you know, it's a writer's strike movie. They just sort of cobbled together what they could and released something that I don't think satisfied very many people. But Skyfall is the complete package to me. It's sort of a melding of all of the promise that Daniel Craig showed when he was first hired with the sort of new school action techniques, sort of moving away from the Bourne franchise at long last, because, you know, I like Casino Royale, but you look at that movie now and it's very obviously made in the shadow of the Bourne films. This sort of takes these new school action techniques and sort of melds them with old school Bond tropes and flourishes, all filmed beautifully by cinematographer Roger Deakins and with a very steady eye by director Sam Mendes, who I wouldn't have pegged as being honestly capable of producing action on this grand scale, but boy did he. He pulled it off with aplomb.
You mentioned the flourishes of the Bond movies. You know, you have the quips, the villain, the gadgets, the women, the action. This has all of that.
Yeah.
And it totally delivers there, but it seems to go beyond that. It transcends the typical Bond movie. And I'm not saying that this is the best Bond movie out there. I think it's a lot different, and it's definitely up there for sure.
Probably in my top five.
It's in the conversation.
It's not the best.
Yeah. But you have to ask yourself at some point, how good can a Bond movie be? And I think that this movie shows you how good a Bond movie can be, but then you get out of that conversation and just start saying, and the reason why we're talking about major awards for this is that this is not just a great Bond movie, this is a great film, and this is what people were saying about the Christopher Nolan Batman movies. It's not just a great comic book movie, it's a great film, and we have to put it alongside the other great films of that particular year, and Skyfall belongs in that conversation. I think a problem that I've had with Daniel Craig's run so far as Bond is this, what I felt like is kind of an overzealous effort to humanize James Bond, whereas we've just sort of known him as, again, as this quippy, suave ladies' man of a British agent who has this license to kill or whatever and is sort of this cog in these spy movies, these genre pictures. But I think for the first time in these three movies, it really works. And I think that when they delve into Bond's past, you actually finally feel like it's effective and it works for the story and it works for the overall arc of the James Bond character, something we've never really had to think about. You could make an argument for On Her Majesty's Secret Service, but really until the Daniel Craig films. And again, for me, it's the first time it's really worked. But again, when you boil it down to just being a James Bond film, everything on that level totally works. And you get great action sequences. And my God, that Aston Martin is just so beautiful. And the way that's introduced is just fantastic. And obviously has a lot of respect for the James Bond franchise. So yeah, Sam Mendes certainly lends a certain kind of integrity that I think the James Bond franchise was missing for a while. So it was great. And Judi Dench and Javier Bardem are fantastic. But, I mean, where you say, yep, I just say Skyfall is just dope, man. It's just a dope movie. So yeah.
Javier Bardem, I think, will be a welcome surprise for a Best Supporting Actor nomination at the Academy Awards. Not that I think that will be a surprise anymore after the SAG nomination. Did he get a Golden Globe nomination, too? I don't remember.
We'll figure it out. I don't think so. But yeah, we'll talk about that later. Moving on, the latest from Robert Zemeckis, his return to live action filmmaking since he got lost in that mocap 3D nightmare of a trend that he tried to get going.
You don't think Christmas Carol is the best film of 2009?
No, and I don't think I'd say it on national television either.
Really?
No.
I wonder if anybody would.
Or did. No, I don't. And I'm a big fan of Robert Zemeckis. I'm a huge Back to the Future nerd. And I love Forrest Gump. I think it's great. And
Forrest Gump is awesome.
Yeah, I love his last movie, Castaway. I think it's awesome. I think the guy can make a great film. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? This guy I'll always give a chance.
I'll go to the bat for Contact. I love Contact.
I love Contact, too. Sure, why not? But the mocap stuff, forget it. I'm glad he's back in the live-action realm. But I've got to say, I'm extremely disappointed with this movie.
I didn't care for it either.
Well, this new movie he has, Flight, starring Denzel Washington, starts incredibly strong. You have a great performance, I think, throughout most of the entire movie from Washington, who has been sort of coasting and phoning in his performances with stuff like Safe House and other, again, genre movies that have just been vehicles for the guy late in his career. But he's finally acting again. Like Tommy Lee Jones was acting again in Lincoln. It's good to see these old-timers back at it. But after this phenomenal crash sequence that kicks the movie off, and it's as good as the Castaway crash sequence, in my opinion, if not even more intense. It's just what Zemeckis is so good at, actually grabbing the audience as they're watching this movie and making them feel tense and feel scared for the characters on screen and for themselves in something as almost interactive as that.
This is Southjet 227. We're in an uncontrolled dive. We got a jam stabilizer or something.
Oh, Lord, we're coming out of 7,000. I see nothing but acid.
When I say I want you to retract the flaps, retract the gear, trim us nose down, okay?
Trim down? What are you going to do?
Margaret, when I tell you I want you to push these forward, full throttle, can you do that?
Yeah.
Okay, when I tell
you... Wait, sir, what are we doing? Why would I trim down?
We're going to roll it, okay?
What do you mean roll it?
We got to do something to stop this dive. Here we go.
I can imagine what this movie would be like in a D-box seat. But it turns into this movie of the week, after-school special, with the subtlety of a very special episode of MTV's Real World, when it touches on this addiction plot that wasn't heavily advertised when this movie was marketed. But honestly, for me, it turns into just this drinking is bad, okay, film that Denzel Washington can't really do much with, even with his level of expertise.
Yeah, there's not one sobriety platitude this movie doesn't hit. And Washington's performance, and you took the words right out of my mouth, this does feel like the first time in a while he's felt like super committed to the material. It keeps you engaged, but that only goes so far when what you're engaged with is sort of this soapy morass of cliche, like Flight is for most of its, you know, runtime. And then you get to the ending where the film actually has an opportunity to do something interesting, and it sort of cops out and goes the safe sort of moralistic route. I wasn't feeling that. I didn't want to come to see this movie to be preached at or anything like that. I feel like, you know, the movie was preachy is sometimes a lazy criticism. But with Flight, I mean, not only does it preach at you, it hits you on the head over and over again with its message all throughout. That's not to say, like you said, some of the technical work is fairly good. You know, Zemeckis is at the top of his game or somewhere near it. But you can only elevate this material so much, particularly when you know, most of your supporting characters don't really have any depth at all and just exist to sort of promote, I guess, this message and this moralizing. It didn't really work for me at all.
It's a PSA. It's not really much more than that. It's like one of those NBC PSAs, the more you know.
Well, you have this supporting character played by Kelly Riley, this sort of heroin junkie,
walking stereotype.
Who she exists solely to deliver this message and to serve as a public service announcement. You're totally correct.
But she's just one of those tools that does that and serves the movie that way. But in my opinion, if you totally eliminate her from this movie,
nothing is different.
No.
I mean, it's like 30 minutes shorter, which probably wouldn't hurt.
No.
But nothing is different. And then the movie wants to have its cake and eat it too, with John Goodman as this sort of wacky, triumphant drug dealer who gets, you know, has some really funny moments and gets some really nice laugh lines. But the movie doesn't go there. It doesn't go to that place of darkness, and it doesn't want to attempt to have that moral ambiguity that it sort of flirts with. In the end, it sort of retreats into something safe.
Oh, and just with one of the biggest cop-out endings I've ever seen in recent years. It's
huge
awful.
Huge cop-out ending.
Yeah, it's awful. But you mentioned this John Goodman character, and he's actually getting a lot of acclaim, and this movie is too, to my surprise. But there's this scene where he has relapsed suddenly,
yeah,
and he's drunk, and he's, you know, he has to somehow come down from this and become sober, and they call in this drug dealer, I guess, and John Goodman to come in and sort of bring him back down to earth by giving him a few lines of cocaine.
Which is a wonder drug that can solve most problems, according to this movie.
And what message are they trying to send with that scene, too? I came out of that feeling kind of icky, you know what I mean?
Don't drink, but coke is fine.
Yeah, if you
drink.
Or
if you drink, make sure you do coke.
Yeah,
in copious amounts.
That'll sober you up. And you
I mean, I know that's not what the movie is trying to say, and it's trying to sort of present this look at the gritty side of addiction or whatever, but it doesn't really do that. And then, it immediately, right after that, cops out and says, well, you know, even though we've sort of hinted that maybe his condition is the reason that he sort of flew the plane as well as he did in the first place, and he just sort of reacted on instinct because he was under the influence of alcohol and drugs, they're still bad and you shouldn't do them. I was expecting something a little bit, if not edgier, at least something a little bit more even-handed. Not that I expected a Hollywood studio movie to promote recreational drug use as being a positive, but at the same time, the cop-out feels so unnatural in the end that it's just, you come out of it thinking, well, what was the point of any of it?
Yeah, there's nothing gritty about this movie whatsoever. It doesn't intend to answer any tough questions with tough answers. It's extremely simple. It's just, if you drink, it's a bad thing. Don't get drunk. Don't drink and drive. It's nothing we don't already know or we weren't taught when we were kids. This shouldn't be an R-rated film for adults. This is something that should be aimed at children and shown in elementary schools, to be honest with you.
And Zemeckis has never met a moment that he didn't want to overemphasize with a very on-the-nose music cue.
The song choices here are so just...
Yeah.
They're just so weak and so obvious. And, I'm interested in a movie like Flight, which to me was marketed as a difficult scenario for the characters in terms of this guy was under the influence when he flew the plane. Yes, that's a bad thing, and he should be charged for that. But he happened to save hundreds of lives with his instincts and his expertise and skills and how he flew this plane. And there you get into this moral quandary and this conflict that people who would be charging him face for having to charge and prosecute a hero. That, to me, is a more interesting movie, but instead they take a really cheap way out and, again, tell this after-school special in the most by-the-numbers way they possibly could have.
It's pretty banal. And, disappointment. I won't be upset if Denzel Washington is singled out for his performance because, again, I think it's worthwhile and it's really the only thing that makes the movie worth seeing if you're inclined to see it, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Well, another movie that is definitely worth seeing, I think, is Ben Affleck's easily far and away his best directorial effort, and I don't think it's even close.
What was the last movie you produced?
High and Dry.
Who paid for that?
CFDC.
What's your middle name? What's your middle name? What's your middle name?
Leon?
Shoot him. He's an American spy.
Look, they're going to try to break you, okay? By trying to get you agitated. You have to know your resume back to front.
You really believe your little story is going to make a difference when there's a gun to our heads?
I think my story is the only thing between you and a gun to your head.
Argo, this is a film that was considered a front runner to win Best Picture a long time ago, even before it came out.
Yeah.
And I think what you get here is an incredibly suspenseful, very thrilling, funny, in a lot of cases, well-performed film that I would recommend to just about anybody. And to me, it feels less cinematic, honestly, than it does like damn good television in a way. And
not that that's a criticism.
It's not, because there's some damn good TV out there, yeah. And there's some cinematic television out there for that matter. I think that you get the suspense here in this movie that you rarely get in movies in general these days, especially on a mainstream level like this. Look, I think it's a really good movie, and I'm fine with it being in the race. And again, I think it's Ben Affleck's best movie to date, because I wasn't a huge fan of The Town or Gone Baby Gone.
I like Gone Baby Gone a lot.
I think they're serviceable. But there are some issues that I had, and we'll touch on it in a minute, but I just want to know from you. I mean, do you think that this is his best movie?
Yeah, I think so. I think it probably is. I think it's really good. He has a deft hand with a large ensemble of actors. Not that he didn't in his previous work, but this is a cast of largely unknowns doing unrecognizable sort of character actor work, most of whom are really, really effective and really good. Then you've got some recognizable faces like John Goodman again here, and
more Alan effective Arkin. In this, yeah.
Yeah, I think they're both a lot of fun. It sort of deftly mixes tone from the comedic aspects of the sort of ridiculous CIA plot to the thriller aspects of what happens when you actually get into Iran, and sort of how do you, the situation being, how do you get these people out right under the nose of angry revolutionaries. And it is a lot of fun. A question that I have for you is that I've talked to three people who had the same reaction to the ending of the movie that I just never occurred to me, and that's that Affleck ratchets up the tension a bridge too far, that not only are they narrowly escaping here or stopped here, but it's just a series of close calls that strains plausibility. Is that something that you observed or bothered you?
It doesn't really bother me. I buy that. Yeah. I buy the argument.
I understand the argument. Yeah. It didn't bother me either.
He takes so many liberties, I think, in terms of like the actual true events, yeah, and how they occurred. Because once you get on the runway here and all these things start happening, or when they're in a car and the car won't start, yeah, and they get stuck in the middle of a protest, yeah, and all this stuff. It's really interesting, and it's very suspenseful.
At the airport.
Yeah, so much happens at the airport. And again, when they finally approach the tarmac there, he does ratchet it up, and there are a lot of things that happens just so conveniently,
right,
but it works in terms of the story that he's trying to tell. And if you came to see something that was just by the numbers based on the true story, and if he told it, again, by the book, as it happened, it might not be nearly as thrilling, or it may have, who knows, but the result, I think, is entertaining.
I mean, the thing about Argo is, it is a sort of wide-ranging crowd pleaser. It's grossed over $100 million at the box office. It should be said that Flight is nearing that, and Lincoln will have passed it today, so this has been a very good fall for adult, you know, entertainment, not in that sense, but Argo is the sort of movie that is made so infrequently, which is a reasonably intelligent thriller for adults, that it seems to almost be receiving a lot of awards attention by default, just because it's one of the only games out there. It's the sort of movie that people should be making more of, to be honest. And it probably isn't the best example of that sort of thing, but the fact that it's so entertaining and easy to watch gets it a lot of mileage this year. It's one of those weird things about the studio system right now, that they're sort of baffled when a well-made movie like this makes a lot of money and continue not to learn lessons from it. But that's just the name of the game right now. It's one of those things that I don't really understand, and maybe they'll learn their lessons from these movies sort of overperforming this fall, but probably not.
Well, a complaint that I've heard a pretty fair amount of recently, especially on the show that we like, Film Spotting, mm-hmm, from one of its critics, Josh Larson, is the depiction Affleck gives of Iranians, and how for the most part in this movie they're depicted as villains, and these shouting, angry, bearded, scary individuals who most of the time are out to get these Americans that are on the run from the Iranian rebels. And I hear where they're coming from, but I don't think that's true for the most part in Argo. You have plenty of Iranian characters who I think are depicted fairly and well, but the main problem that I think I have with this movie, and where I think the film falls a little bit short, is not only with Affleck's leading man, who is just sort of this bland know-it-all. I don't think his performance is necessarily all that good. I think it's serviceable to the movie. Mm-hmm. It's just your typical Ben Affleck role. But I don't think the movie gives us enough reasons beyond our nationalism and hoping for the safety of Americans in a situation like this. But I don't think it gives us much of a reason to give a crap about the folks who need rescuing. And these U.S. Embassy employees, I think it's interesting that they have the wherewithal to escape this embassy as it's being raided. But, you know, in the end, they do sort of leave their colleagues there high and dry and left alone and left to deal with this crisis that lasts for part of a year or maybe a little over a year. Yeah, these escapees, these fugitives, they find shelter in this Canadian ambassador's sort of swanky penthouse where it shows them enjoying these fancy dinners and like drinking wine and, you know, cajoling with one another. And when Ben Affleck and the CIA finally come to their rescue, they whine about it. They complain. And I think that the pace of this film, as breathless as it is almost a blessing and a curse, because it has to move so fast that it barely has any time to actually slow down and develop these characters. And again, you have these sort of these unknowns, so to speak. I mean, we know who Tate Donovan is, and we know who some of the actors are, but for the most part, unknown people who are sort of faceless here. Rory Cochrane, who I think is interestingly designed anyway. you have some moments where they do try to develop these guys and make them worth liking and make us want to see their rescue finally happen. But for me, it just fell short in that regard, and I wanted them to kind of endure what their colleagues endured. I'd rather their colleagues be rescued and not them if they were going to react that way to it. But again, the movie has to move too fast, and it's not enough of a fault where I think the film suffers too much for it. Again, this is a jam-packed movie, and it's as thrilling as advertised, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I'd like to single out, I guess, Scoot McNairy's performance as one of the sort of abandoned CIA people hiding in the Canadian ambassador's house. He's the sort of reluctant, or the most reluctant, or the whiniest of the bunch, and he has what would pass as a character arc. You know, that's not a criticism that I really felt during the movie, but, you know, pointing it out, I guess just the sheer propulsion of Argo sort of gets the job done and, you know, leaves you satisfied.
Yeah, and how about their attempt to add depth to the Affleck character, too, his calling his son on the phone and showing that he's a sort of a deadbeat dad who's trying to make nice. It just, to me, that kind of falls flat on its face, and there's this scene towards the end of the movie that is completely unearned involving Affleck and his family. Didn't totally work for me. I think the movie really gels and works extremely well when they're planning this ploy. The charade is being developed by Affleck and these movie guys, John Goodman and Alan Arkin, and they have this really funny table read where these people come in costume, and it's sort of juxtaposed with this kind of scary sequence involving the people who are in the embassy and are facing possible execution. It's a really dark sequence and done really well, and I like the parallel that they have there. But it's interesting that you just said Scoot McNairy was in Argo, because it makes for a nice transition into our next movie.
Yeah, I brought
movie.
It up as sort of a segue.
Because I didn't know that was him.
Really?
Yeah, until you said that. I knew who he was in this next film, Killing Them Softly, the new film from Andrew Dominik starring Brad Pitt and Scoot McNairy, but yeah, I had no clue that was him in Argo.
Yeah.
So job well done to the folks in Argo. Even though I didn't know who he was going into Killing Them Softly, he's kind of a fresh face for me. I haven't really seen him in much else. But speaking of some of these political messages that we get in films like Argo and Lincoln, for that matter, you have Killing Them Softly now, which was previously known as its better title, Kogan's Trade, based on the book. It's hard to explain what this movie is about. It's about lowlives, first of all, these folks who live in this horrible, killer-be-killed, dog-eat-dog world where money is the one and only precious commodity. It's the thing that drives them, and honestly, what the film says is that it's what drives human beings, and it's what we're all after.
Certainly America.
Yeah, American. You know, especially in this economy that the film depicts, it takes place in 2008 in the midst of this presidential election. It tells you that from the get-go, too. It opens in a very interesting way. They make a very interesting style decision, and I think the movie it's gonna be made or broken for a lot of people with that opening. If you can survive that first minute and a half of Killing Them Softly, I think you won't wind up walking out of the theater.
Judging by reactions to the film by audiences, mostly broken, I would say.
Yeah, probably. If you get past that, I think you're probably gonna enjoy a really funny and stylish gangster film to some extent that has a lot to say on Americans' obsession with money and how they get it and who they're looking out for, which is number one. And there's an incredible way I think that this movie ends, and we won't give that away, yeah. But I don't think
it's pretty much if people bothered to see it, it would be a classic ending.
Yeah, it is. And I think that it sums the movie up incredibly well and sends home this point that it's been trying to make the entire time, which has been fairly obvious, especially the way you hear televisions and radios, and it seems like it's a little in your face at times, but I think the culmination of it is what you see in that scene is incredibly effective, and that's something that I think that's a message that does need to be relayed to Americans as they're watching films like this. They need to be reminded of that sometimes.
It's relayed, and it's relayed, and relayed, mm-hmm. and relayed, and relayed. I mean, obviously Killing Them Softly is not a movie that's setting out to be subtle in any way, in any fashion. The message of this movie, which is incredibly bleak, about the sort of rottenness at the core of American capitalism, is delivered over and over again, like a shotgun blast to the face of the audience over and
well
over
put.
And over and over and over again, which didn't bother me, but I can see how people would come away from that thinking, okay, all right, we get it. We hear them talking in the background. Every television on every like CD bar or household in this film or hotel room is playing C-SPAN or some sort of news report on the financial crisis.
But think about where it's being played.
No, I don't think that that's a negative necessarily,
right?
Because you know, when this card game that sort of forms the crux of the action here, it's held up by these two lowlives played by Scoot McNairy and Ben Mendelsohn, who's awesome in pretty much everything he's done.
He's just disgusting.
Yeah,
in this
he's
movie.
So gross.
Yeah.
But it's held up, and in the background is this television talking about a crisis of confidence and how important it is to regain confidence in the financial system, which is, of course, what we see depicted in microcosm in the sort of low-life, small money hood organization here, personified by this mid-level mob lawyer played by Richard Jenkins, who says, you know, we need to find a way to rebuild confidence in these card games, because without it, the whole sort of organized crime financial system is ruined. So the fact that the movie is drawing a parallel so directly between organized crime financial system and the American financial system is obviously not subtle. This movie is not, it doesn't have nuance on its mind. It's here to impart this bleak message and very little else, but it is terrifically funny. Like you said, you know, there's a lot of moments of style and interesting choices from Andrew Dominik that are a lot of fun to watch. I didn't love this movie. It didn't come together in a way that, say, like The Assassination of Jesse James, which is an all-timer for me, did. But, I mean, it's a very different sort of movie. It's a down and dirty sort of very fast-paced, for what it is, 90-minute sort of crime movie, whereas the other is an elegiac Western that runs about 2.5 days. So I don't know. I mean, like it didn't strike me as like a crime film masterpiece, but it is the sort of thing that I can see growing in estimation, not only with myself, but with filmgoers at large. It seems destined for cult status, especially amongst the very cynical.
I think there is some subtlety to the movie, actually, and I think a lot of it comes in the form of James Gandolfini's character, uh-huh. who sort of jumps in the middle of this movie unexpectedly, and we sort of trail off into his numb universe.
He's totally depressed.
He is, and he's this mobster this hitman who's brought in to do half of this job and to take out half of this team who has robbed this card game, and Brad Pitt, who is friends with him and knows him and brings him in to do this job, is just sort of depressed by his depression. He just sees what has become of this guy who we learn was one of, I guess, the best, so to speak, in their profession. But now you do have this new corporate system of organized crime, which is really funny to me how the mafia has become a corporation. Mm-hmm. And carries out these jobs by committee vote. And you have that message delivered via Richard Jenkins. But I think that, you know, you have Gandolfini's character, who is just so bathed in excess and overexposed to it, who represents a guy who needs the money more than anybody but is too lazy to get the job done or actually put in the hard work that it takes to earn that money. And so I think that his character is extremely interesting.
Go get him now. We'll set the thing up. Go get him.
You, I'm going to tell you what you're going to do. You're going to go to bed. I'm going to call you at 7:30. And if I don't wake you up, I am going to drop a dime on a couple of cops I know. I'm going to take you back to where you're supposed to be.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. No ass, no more booze, no nothing. Get yourself a shower and go to bed. I'll get you up and tell you where you gotta be.
I don't take orders from you.
7:30. Get some sleep.
I think that the way they use the audio of the politicians via TV and radio, yeah, it hits you over the head, and you always know it's happening. You know it's there every single time that it happens. And they even show a billboard of Barack Obama and John McCain.
Yeah.
And it is overt. But I think that the way they do it is extremely ironic in some cases and is used for comedic effect, especially when it's playing in these low-lives cars or in this crappy bars television, as if they would be listening to that or watching that on television. No way they would be. But obviously Dominic does it. And I think it's effective. But I want to go back really fast to the card game sequence and the robbery. That's one of the tensest moments, I think, of the year.
It's just very good.
Just an extremely well-directed, very well-acted sequence. And you always just have this awful feeling that something horrible is about to happen. Not that you should care because everybody in the room is a piece of garbage. But the guys who are doing it are just these morons who have no clue what they're in for. And it's almost like the fact that it's going so right throughout the scene is probably what's going wrong.
Yeah.
I was always waiting for this extremely sawed-off shotgun to go off at some point, and I was kind of disappointed that it didn't.
It's a pretty comical way to build up tension, sort of really, really sawed-off shotgun and the possibility of it going off and just murdering
everybody. It's just like this handheld nub of a gun with the bullets kind of sticking out of the barrel.
I mean, if you approach this film as a dark comedy and you have the sort of disposition to appreciate extraordinarily dark comedy, then I don't see how Killing Them Softly will be an unpleasurable experience for you. But obviously, the vast majority of American audiences who paid money to see this film were unsatisfied in one way or another. Probably because they expected some sort of Brad Pitt gangster hitman lark and got something a little, I don't know, a little bleaker than that.
Well, that sort of does it for me for these movies that we've missed out on talking about for the past couple of months.
Yeah.
I know that you have seen Life of Pi,
the new
Ang Lee film, and that's one that I really want to see, and I might see tonight as we're talking.
Yeah.
But just give me a quick glimpse into how you feel about that.
You know, I have complicated feelings about the ending of Life of Pi, which I think is going to prove somewhat divisive, but people seem to really enjoy this film, and it is a film that is a visual just marvel. It's magnificent looking, especially in 3D, which is how Ang Lee shot it. It's something that I didn't really know what to expect of when I went into it and came away just sort of dazzled by it. From a storytelling perspective, I think that there are some shaky aspects, but just on sheer spectacle alone, it's really marvelous. It's got to be, you know, right up there for platitudes for the best cinematography and best visual effects of the year. Just really, really terrific work.
And I think it's made more than $60 million domestically at this point. Do you think that this is a film that, it obviously has to some degree, but something that will, from now until, say, when the Oscars air, something that will be able to connect with mainstream audiences?
It seems to be connecting in a big way. And again, it is the sort of film that is important to see on the big screen. It's something that you really do need to check out in the best display possible. But from a storytelling perspective, it has this easygoing sort of spiritualism that provides the backbone of its plot, which is, you know, this young man. It focuses mostly on this young man who finds himself adrift after a shipwreck in a lifeboat with a Bengal tiger, and they have to find ways to coexist. It does an admirable job at not making the tiger seem any less fierce than it probably would be in a real-life situation, adding to my unnatural neuroses, now a fear of being stuck in a close quarter with a tiger. That just doesn't sound like a satisfying situation for anybody, but it is the sort of thing that sort of gets deeper and richer as it goes on, and then later on further consideration. Though the ending, I think the ending is going to put some people off, and I don't want to get into that, especially if you're going to see it tonight.
Well, we've caught up on a few of the fall movies that we haven't been able to talk about just yet, and a lot of these are going to figure into this major conversation about awards that has emerged in the past couple of weeks thanks to the nominations from SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, and the Golden Globes. We've heard from the New York critics, the LA critics, nominations now from the broadcast film critics, and a lot of other guilds and critic circles are revealing their winners. So we're right in the middle of this precursor stretch where we're sort of zeroing in on what the favorites are in terms of the big Oscar picture and what's winding up on a lot of people's top 10 lists as we're forming our own too. There are still three big movies that we have yet to see that are probably going to figure into our own conversation. And one has just been racking up when it comes to these critics awards and is probably now has to be considered a top three favorite to win Best Picture, and we haven't seen it, and it's Catherine Bigelow's Zero Dark Thirty. Another is one that really scored at the Golden Globes today, and it's Quentin Tarantino's new film, Django Unchained, this violent and just gory and, from what I can gather, sort of hard to watch in some cases, but somehow, at the same time, extremely entertaining spaghetti western starring Jamie Foxx and Leonardo DiCaprio and Christoph Waltz, both of whom were nominated for Golden Globes. It's nominated for five, I think, including picture and director and screenplay.
Yeah.
So you have that. And then a film that nobody seems to be talking about, you've got a Peter Jackson Hobbit movie out this week.
Yeah.
A film that you're seeing tonight.
Yeah.
And it's not figuring into this conversation. And it's because it's getting weak buzz right now. But the fact that they weren't talking about it before that is what boggles my mind.
Yeah, that is unusual, but the reviews are generally pleasant, if not
so-so.
Yeah, they're not especially laudatory. One film that you forgot to mention that also comes out on Christmas Day is Tom Hooper's Les Misérables.
It's got to be
in the conversation.
It's not even in the back of my mind.
It's got to be in the conversation. A best director winner coming off of his best picture winning film. With an adaptation of a beloved musical that seems like it's going to rack up a ton of Academy Award nominations, even with reviews coming in that are generally pretty tepid, it seems. You know, apart from the sort of rapturous early screenings that this film received, now that it's being reviewed by major critics, a lot of them don't like it. Not that I think that's going to make a difference. I think that your average Academy voter is going to go into this and say, well, it made my heart feel good, and they're going to vote for it because that's just what the Academy does. But yeah, you have the critics darling, like you said, Zero Dark Thirty seems to be the emerging consensus favorite there, with Spielberg's Lincoln as sort of critical outlier, racking up for Daniel Day-Lewis in most major awards so far, but not for the picture itself. And then Django Unchained seems to have had a pretty significant surge this week, probably as it has just started screening. I heard that they worked on the film until very, very recently, only locking it maybe a week and a half ago. But you've got to expect that a lot of attention will be paid to the new Quentin Tarantino film, no matter what it is, what its subject matter is, and or what have you, especially one, as they all have been, actually, especially one touted by Harvey Weinstein, who will push Tarantino till the cows come home just because they're so buddy-buddy. But you have Tarantino coming off of one of his most successful films, artistically, I would say, and financially, almost certainly, with Inglourious Basterds. You have Catherine Bigelow coming off of her picture and director-winning film, The Hurt Locker. You have Tom Hooper coming off of The King's Speech. You have Spielberg back in the saddle with Lincoln, and David O. Russell coming off of The Fighter with a very well respected but weirdly, bizarrely distributed comedy, Silver Linings Playbook, which I saw at the New Orleans Film Festival. You haven't seen it yet, obviously, so we won't talk too much about it. Then you also have Argo and Life of Pi. That seems to round out the significant Best Picture contenders at this point. I could be forgetting something. But, you know, you look at that list and you say, well, we've got Lincoln, which is making bank, and we've got Les Mis, which is going to probably make bank, and we've got Zero Dark Thirty, which the critics love. You know, this seems to me to be the most wide-open Best Picture race in a long time.
I think it's going to come down to three movies right now. If I had to pick, I'm tossing Life of Pi out. It's out.
Yeah, I don't think it's a contender to win. But I think it might
score a nomination.
Yeah, I think it'll be a player.
Fine. The three that I think are the contenders at this point are Zero Dark Thirty, Lincoln, and Silver Linings Playbook.
You don't think Les Mis has it?
I think it's almost as out as Life of Pi.
I see. To be honest with you, when it starts making that money, and
I'm not sure how much money it's going to make, man.
Comes out. I mean,
I really don't. I really don't know. I don't know. Like, I know people love the play, but I know people generally like musicals, and musicals have done well to some extent. I just don't know how pumped people are going to be to go see a musical about the French Revolution. Even though it makes people feel good, there's a lot of suffering in it, and I'm not sure that so many people are going to want to sit through that on Christmas Day. And I might be proven wrong.
I would dispute that.
I don't think it's going to be a smash hit or anything.
I don't think that the alternatives that people have on Christmas Day are going to be movies that you can take the entire family to, like Les Mis. Django might be the preferred choice for you and I.
Right, but if my parents took me to Les Mis, I know I'd, number one, fall asleep, and number two, just be disappointed.
Well, that's probably true, but most people, I think that is going to be their Christmas Day movie of choice, unless they go see Skyfall or The Hobbit again,
mm-hmm.
which is...
I think The Hobbit's going to be going strong. I think
unless
despite,
people hate it this weekend.
Well, I think despite the critical reception that it's gotten so far, which, like you said, has been fairly lukewarm, I think the geeks out there and the people who love those Lord of the Rings movies as much as they still do,
yeah.
I think they're going to be loyal, and this movie's going to make a lot of money.
I don't disagree. It's just it's one of those things where you've got all of these movies coming out within a week and a half of each other. And you still have Silver Linings Playbook out there somewhere, mm-hmm. going to expand at some point.
Yeah, that Silver Linings Playbook, the X factor here, and why it might not be as much of a contender is probably because of this distribution platform or the way they're the way that they're distributing this movie is bizarre, utterly bizarre. Because this seems like the movie that would win audiences over and something that they would absolutely love to see on Christmas Day. It doesn't seem like most of us are going to get that opportunity.
Well, speaking from an educated perspective here, it is.
Yeah.
It is all of that. And the fact that it built up ahead of steam in September when it started premiering at festivals and played at festivals all throughout October and had this wide release planned on, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, only to be scuttled at the last minute. That blows my mind, particularly since, they're going to start platforming it around Thanksgiving, and it'll surely get into wide release. I thought December 7th. I thought the week before The Hobbit, which was wide open. You have this totally wide open weekend that has nothing but this Gerard Butler movie that nobody saw.
Well, you've got three Weinstein movies in the picture right now. One of them that is no longer figuring prominently, which is The Master, which had this just ridiculously early release date if it wanted to compete. And like you have said before, it is an extremely difficult and inaccessible movie for wide audiences.
Well, this is what I thought they were going to do with The Master,
uh-huh.
by releasing it in mid-September. I thought they would have it on Blu-ray by Christmas. So it would be in voters' mailboxes. I mean, I guess it still is via DVD screener, but I thought that it would have a home video release already by now to remind people of it.
Yeah.
And now it's just... But I guess they put all their money on Silver Linings Playbook and now Django.
It seems, that's the thing. It's like, has Harvey and just has the Weinstein Company put all of its eggs in one basket in terms of Django? Do they like their chances with that now? I don't think that I would put it in that upper tier just yet.
I remain to be convinced with it, too.
Yeah, but the fact that it is winding up on these lists and winning some awards and is getting nominated for just about everything... Mm-hmm. That has me thinking otherwise, but so did Inglourious Basterds. And in the end, I don't think we really considered that a viable contender.
Not that year. Not the year of Avatar.
In the Hurt Locker. Yeah, just the strength of those movies. But we do have Tarantino versus Bowl again, part two.
Yeah.
I think it's going to come down to them again, so that's interesting.
For original screenplay, I mean, there are no contenders this year. There's like those two and like Moonrise Kingdom.
The Master will get a nomination.
Looper.
Yeah.
Looper's won a ton of critics' awards, so...
Yeah, critics love unofficial X-Men sequels.
Oh, God.
I guess that's...
Is that like the last show we recorded is your dumb opinion on Looper and my correct one?
I think we gotta have
a reprise of that.
I think so. Yeah. Let's not go there.
Great film.
Let's not go there.
But it seems like most of the contenders are adapted screenplay contenders like Lincoln and Silver Linings Playbook and Argo, right there, you have three very strong contenders for that award. And then you have outliers like Life of Pi and probably some other stuff that I don't remember.
Battleship.
Yes.
Yeah. Quite the adaptation. Yeah. But no, I mean, is there anything like right now that you have your eye on? I mean, you look at these SAG and Golden Globe nominees and you start talking about snubs and surprise nominee. With Golden Globes, you just kind of have to expect there's going to be some surprise. You know, I joked with you that we were going to, upon the Golden Globes news, we're going to do a two-hour salmon fishing in the Yemen episode where we just talk about that nonstop.
It's such a forgettable movie.
But, yeah, that somehow racked up some nominations with the Golden Globes. Yeah. But, you know, if you want to talk about some snubs, you know, one of the movies that is expected by many to get a Best Picture nomination and maybe figure into some of the major categories is Beasts of the Southern Wild.
I always expected the Golden Globes to snub that.
It makes sense.
They tend to snub distinctly American independent films. I mean, it's
got no stars.
It's got no stars. It's pretty well removed from their sensibilities. It's not something I ever expected to figure into that. And its performances were deemed ineligible for SAG because none of the first-time actors and non-actors are members of the guild.
Yeah.
So I don't think that anything is settled on Beasts of the Southern Wild. It's hard to say, but the jury's still out there. I still think it has a pretty decent shot at making an impact in some categories.
I guess the Hollywood Foreign Press, they're not in the same category. I guess that it would be in the drama category, right? But I was going to say, you know, if you had the choice of getting this young lady whose name I will never be able to pronounce.
Quvenzhané? Maybe.
Maybe. Or in Dwight Henry, is that the guy's
Dwight
name?
Henry.
Would you rather have them in the building or Ewan McGregor and Emily Blunt, who are both nominees, I think?
Or Marianne Cotillard and Helen Mirren.
Exactly.
To point out two people who popped up in actress drama in two movies that I have seen and didn't think about.
Marianne Cotillard's got an Oscar nomination coming.
Inexplicably.
It's coming.
That's not a good movie.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. And, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing it because I love the, you know, some of the director's work. And obviously, I'm a Cotillard fan.
Jacques Audiard hit it out of the park with A Prophet.
But, yeah.
Rust and Bone.
It's got no legs.
You might say that, yeah. You know, Helen Mirren, after seeing Hitchcock and sort of just knowing that Helen Mirren has a tendency to pop into this category just whenever she does anything, yeah, you know, this is not outside of the realm of possibility. I kind of figured that she would make an appearance there in an unusually, well, not a weak Best Actress category necessarily, but a Best Actress category where it's hard to point to any front runner or any consensus forming other than perhaps the inevitable Jessica Chastain in Zero Dark Thirty versus Jennifer Lawrence in Silver Linings Playbook showdown, which is what I think this is going to boil down to.
I think supporting actor, which is one of my favorite categories, you know, it's usually the most competitive.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be just as competitive.
It's wide open this year.
Well, I think the favorites you have to turn to at this point are probably Tommy Lee Jones and, surprisingly, Philip Seymour Hoffman. I think he's up there.
I don't think so.
So then it's Tommy Lee Jones.
It's Tommy Lee Jones or maybe Leonardo DiCaprio if he squeaks in. Just because it's Leonardo DiCaprio. He's never won. He's got a Tarantino villain role, which is good to actors.
Big star.
Yeah, big star. I mean, but you also have Robert De Niro delivering a serious performance in a serious movie.
Is this okay? Is it a great performance? Just tell me this. Is it a great performance or is it just his first good performance in like 15 years?
Well, I don't think it's his first good performance in like 15 years, but it's one of a handful of really good performances in 15 years. I think that it is a very good performance. I wouldn't say it's a great performance, but it provides an anchor to that movie.
Is he going
to
win the Oscar?
No, I think Tommy Lee Jones is going to win the Oscar.
Yeah. Well, okay, and then you have Christoph Waltz, who is getting, you know, some play in the supporting category.
The concern that I have is that the DiCaprio and Waltz might cancel each other's votes out.
Think so.
But I think if DiCaprio is nominated, he'll be a strong contender. I don't think Hoffman's a contender. I don't think Alan Arkin from Argo, if he makes it in, is a contender.
I don't like that nomination.
I don't like that nomination either. I mean, he's fine, but he's doing his Alan Arkin thing in an ensemble. He doesn't really have that much to sink his teeth into, and he's very good in the movie, but it's not... It doesn't strike me as the sort of performance I would nominate.
You know, sometimes there are like actors and just these nominees who squeak into the Oscar race sometimes that are surprises. I have this like suspicion that it could happen if they just ratchet up the campaign a little bit that James Spader might sneak into the supporting actor category.
If he had snuck in at the Golden Globes or SAG, I'd say so. But I don't know, but now, man. I don't think so.
I don't know.
But he is a lot of fun in Lincoln.
Because you see, you know, I'm looking at the SAG nominees, and DiCaprio, obviously, and Waltz didn't make it into that. But you have Javier Bardem from Skyfall. And you said earlier that you think he might squeeze in.
I think he might. I don't know. I mean, just like, I feel like they're going to throw that movie a bone, and his is the most conspicuous performance, and it's very good, and they like him, obviously. They nominated him, you know, for lead actor in 2010 for a movie that nobody really even saw. Beautiful.
If he can squeeze in with that, he can with anything.
I think so, especially for a movie that's nearing $300 million at the box office.
Yeah.
It is widely thought to be the most artistically successful James Bond film in the 50-year history of the franchise. Makes sense to me. I mean, I'm not sold on it, but it seems very possible, and it's a nomination that I would consider probably more worthy than say Alan Arkin, who is just being Alan Arkin.
Yeah. Okay. Another guy who didn't wind up on either of these lists, and it could be detrimental, but a guy who I think deserves to be on it and still could wind up because of the critical love that he's gotten is Matthew McConaughey.
I think he could too.
In Magic Mike.
Yeah, he got a. Wasn't he rewarded by the National Board of Review? Supporting actor. I think that's right.
I want to say New York.
Yeah, maybe that.
Maybe
too.
Gave it to him too.
Oh no, National Board of Review went with DiCaprio. I mean, I feel like just the body of work that he's provided this year with Bernie and Killer Joe and Magic Mike and The Paperboy, which apparently seems to be something that people are actually taking seriously, which we'll touch on in a minute. I mean, that's generally the sort of body of work that's hard to ignore, and he's very good in all of those movies. But, I mean, I guess this year the more conspicuous performances might beat him to it. I don't know. I mean, maybe this isn't his year. I'm sure that he'll have something now that he is approaching at long last legitimacy as an actor with many critics and many audiences.
So you saw The Paperboy?
Yeah, I did. Saw it at the New Orleans Film Festival.
So does Nicole Kidman's recent nominations make sense to you?
I mean, she's the best thing in the movie, but it is a ridiculous, ridiculous movie. It's really kind of terrible. And it's, you know, the sort of movie that, having seen Precious, you take away, like, the anchor of strong performances and a gripping story from Precious, and you leave Lee Daniels all to himself. And it's the sort of movie that you expect out from that.
Uh-huh.
It's just this campy fantasia of sex and murder and bayou nonsense. It's the sort of thing that I can't wait to watch again because I was so just baffled by it and thought it was so, like, terrible, but enjoyably terrible. Like, it's a lot of fun. It's really like this campy, nonsensical trip, and, you know, but that's not the sort of thing that I expected voting, like, awards voting bodies would ever take seriously for awards nominations. And now it looks like Nicole Kidman is in pretty good shape to get a Best Supporting Actress nomination at the Academy Awards, which would mean Lee Daniels, The Paperboy,
Oscar nominee,
therefore be an Oscar nominated film. And that is not something I ever would have imagined.
Well, here's the last thing I want to say about the award stuff before we wrap it up. You know, I talked about Les Mis, and I think it might be out of the picture. And here's the reason why. Any movie where Amanda Seyfried figures prominently, I don't think has a shot at winning Best Picture.
As
a rule.
That rule is made to be broken.
I'm just saying. As a rule, I think that might be the reason it doesn't happen.
I'm not sure that it has what it takes to win anymore.
Yeah.
After the critics have sort of come at it. But it will feature prominently. And it could win. You know, it could be the sort of thing where the heart wins out over, you know, the mind, as we've seen over and over again with these things. There's just no way to tell. You know, we've got a long path ahead of us between now and Oscar night. But I think that at this point, to discount Les Mis entirely is not, you got to count it in.
Hell yeah.
They've been pushing it hard. And, you know, you've got Anne Hathaway, who is the prohibitive favorite for Best Supporting Actress, front and center in this marketing campaign.
Probably the weakest category of the major categories, well, in terms of competition.
Yeah, in terms of competition, she's got it pretty wrapped up, I think.
Yeah, it's hers to lose. Or
unless people really love Lincoln.
Yeah.
And really love Sally Field, which would be fine with me because I think she's great in Lincoln.
They like her, Corey.
Yeah.
They really like her.
Yeah, yeah. There's that. There's that reference.
Maybe they'll really, really like her.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's just, it's the sort, but Hathaway, she's got this air of, well, it's her time. She's put in the work. She's due. And for an epic movie like this that I think is going to hit and hit big, you know, what better time to reward her? But I, you know, I'd be happy to be proven wrong. I haven't seen the film, so I don't even know if I'm going to like it. You might like it, Les Mis. You could see it and think, yeah, that was good.
If I see it.
If you see it?
Yeah, if I see it. I'm really
you
not.
Should, you should see it.
I don't know. It's not looking good right now. I saw some clips from it, and look, sing-talking just doesn't do it for
it's
me.
2 hours and 45 minutes of sing-talking, my friend.
Oh, God. I mean, it's interesting that it's, like, operatic in terms of the format and how everything is sung. 100% of the movie is sung.
Yeah.
And that intrigues me in that I would prefer that to the normal musical format where they're talking and then they break out into song. But when people are singing dialogue to each other, it just weirds me out and makes me uncomfortable.
You just have a thing against musicals.
Yeah, I do. I do. If it's not a Disney cartoon, then I'm not probably.
I dig them, man. I dig musicals. I'm on the fence with this just because I don't really know how it's going to be handled. And it seems like 2 hours and 45 minutes of constant emotional crescendo could get tiresome after a little while. But, you know, we'll see.
Well, let's wrap it up here and talk a little bit about DVD. You should know what's out. I will say, in terms of like home viewing and streaming, I'm in the middle of this movie, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, right now.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, they've driven up to and are walking out into another field right now. So I expect a few more of those.
Like you're riveted.
In the 2 hours left in this movie, so that should be fun. More fields.
It's spoken very highly of.
Yeah, I mean, it's well done for a field movie, you know?
I actually really look forward to seeing that one.
It's the pride of the genre.
Yeah, yeah. Well, new release DVD. There were a ton last week with, like, The Dark Knight Rises and Beasts of the Southern Wild. This week, sort of a lesser week with Seth MacFarlane's comedy Ted, Tony Gilroy's Born Free, The Born Legacy, a movie that I just dislike more and more, you know, as I think about it. And, of course, the fourth Ice Age movie on DVD. I don't know, like, there's not a whole lot happening. Next week is the big DVD release week, the dump right before the holidays, where you have Pitch Perfect and Premium Rush, and then lesser titles like Spike Lee's Red Hook Summer and Nicholas Jarecki's Arbitrage, featuring a Golden Globe nominated performance by Richard Gere. So a lot of good stuff coming out in the next few weeks right before Christmas to check out.
Well, I think that does it for us. We are going to have some parting shots today from our friends in the filmnerds.com community, so we'll go to them right now.
This is Graham Flanagan reporting for Aspect Radio in New York. I was very pleased to finally get the opportunity to see the highly anticipated trailer for the new Guillermo del Toro movie, Pacific Rim, which features giant robots battling giant monsters in the ocean in an effort to save the world. I'm a big fan of anything having to do with giant robot warfare. Big fan of the show Big O that used to air on Adult Swim. Big fan of the Samurai Jack episode where we get some giant robot action. Grew up watching Voltron. I just love the concept of a giant robot being controlled by a human to deal with a giant threat. And I feel like, based on the 2 minutes that I've seen of Pacific Rim in the trailer, this accomplishes what Transformers failed to do. You know, obviously, Transformers had 3 opportunities to give us excellent giant robot warfare, and I feel like I'm not alone when I say that Michael Bay's visual approach left a lot of us confused about what we were seeing on screen. He didn't really give us the opportunity to appreciate the scale of the robots. It seemed like he was more interested in extreme close-ups of the intricacies of the nuts and bolts of the robots while they were transforming, instead of just kind of sitting back, letting the robots fill the frame, and let us watch in awe. Unfortunately, I feel like, even though I'm a Michael Bay fan in general, he missed that opportunity with Transformers. And even though I don't consider myself to be a Guillermo del Toro fan, it seems like with Pacific Rim, it seems like he's on the right track in terms of treating this genre with the respect and the scope that it deserves. So I'm very optimistic about Pacific Rim, and it looks like I'm going to continue to watch that trailer over and over on YouTube until July when the movie comes out.
Until next week, I'm Ben Flanagan.
And I'm Corey Kraft. This is Aspect Radio. Thanks for listening.
How am I doing, Joseph? Thanks. Well, I didn't have a drink.